From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, treating people with AIDS in a small town where most people thought AIDS was a big city problem. Dr. Abraham Verghese worked in Johnson City, Tennessee from 1985 to 1990. Most of the people with AIDS he treated were gay men who were returning to their hometown to die. Dr. Verghese has written a memoir about his medical work in Tennessee. That memoir, My Own Country, is also about his own status as a foreign doctor in America. Dr. Verghese grew up in Ethiopia, where his parents had moved from India. Also today, Ken Tucker reviews The Pretenders' new album, Last of the Independents. The post-punk queen Chrissy Hynde is back after a four-year hiatus. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis was buried at Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia this afternoon, 4 days after her death in New York. The body of the former First Lady was flown there after a private funeral service in Manhattan, attended by her friends and relatives. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Hundreds of spectators waited quietly behind police barricades under a cloudless sky as the mourners arrived at St. Ignatius Loyola Church on Park Avenue. Inside the church, the mood was solemn and respectful. There were readings by Onassis's two children and her longtime friend, Maurice Templesman. The former First Lady's brother-in-law, Senator Edward Kennedy, eulogized Onassis as someone who taught the world how to do things right, how to be a mother, how to appreciate history, and how to be courageous.
No one else looked like her, spoke like her, wrote like her, or was so original in the way she did things. No one we knew ever had a better sense of self.
Those invited to the service included First Lady Hillary Clinton, economist John Kenneth Galbraith, and numerous members of the Kennedy family. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Police in Indianapolis say a bungled robbery started the hostage situation at a Denny's restaurant there. They say they believe that one person was shot dead in the incident. At least five others were injured, including a five-year-old boy who was shot in the face. Officials estimate that several people are being held hostage. It didn't take long for the ceasefire in Rwanda to be violated. The UN brokered a truce that was supposed to go into effect today. Also today, the UN compound itself came under mortar attack. It's not clear yet which warring faction is to blame for the incident. Bosnian Serb forces have failed to meet an agreement to withdraw from a NATO-imposed exclusion zone around the UN safe area of Garajda. Richard Carruthers reports from Zagreb.
UN officials say the Bosnian Serbs did pull out some of their armed policemen from the northern side of Garajda, but they're refusing to withdraw all forces 3 kilometers around the town unless the Muslim-led Bosnian government signs the latest agreement. So far, it's refusing to do so, saying the UN is responsible for enforcing its own safe area. Serbs were meant to have pulled back all their soldiers from Garajda last month, after a NATO airstrike ultimatum eventually halted their offensive. Until the Garajda affair is settled, the Bosnian government says it won't take part in broader negotiations on a countrywide ceasefire. For National Public Radio, this is Richie Carruthers in Zagreb.
On Wall Street this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 25.17 points at 3741.18 in heavy trading of 242 million shares. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq Composite Index is down 2.33 points at 724.37. This is National Public Radio News. The Supreme Court has left intact a ruling that excluded a man from jury duty because of his religion. Just last month, the Supreme Court decided that people can't be kept off a jury because of their sex. In this case, a prosecutor had objected to a Jehovah's Witness as a juror under the theory that members of that religion are reluctant to convict. The Supreme Court has upheld that exclusion. In another case, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that federal judges can't second-guess the administration's decisions on which military bases to close. The ruling is a victory for the Clinton administration's efforts to trim the military budget. After 3 rounds of voting, Germany's ruling conservative coalition stuck together to elect a new national president. The junior coalition partner had nominated a more liberal candidate, a move that threatened to break up the government. NPR's Dieter Berger reports.
In his acceptance speech, Roman Herzog called on Germans to confront the more uncertain future in Europe with unity and resolve. The former conservative head of Germany's constitutional court said he would try to represent all Germans, including those who did not vote for him. He is the first German president to be elected since unification. Initially, Chancellor Helmut Kohl tried without success to nominate a candidate from the eastern part of Germany. Herzog called on his countrymen to treat the eastern Germans as a gain, not a burden. The western part of Germany progressed more rapidly than the east, according to the new president, because of American Reconstruction aid after World War II. In Germany, the president carries out largely ceremonial functions, but outgoing President Richard von Weizsäcker earned worldwide respect for his frank confrontation with Germany's Nazi past. I'm Dieter Berger reporting.
A British gay rights group is asking for a royal pardon for playwright Oscar Wilde, jailed for homosexuality nearly 100 years ago. The group, outraged, says he was the victim of unjust laws. Wilde wrote a number of plays that mocked Britain's straight-laced society. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. Abraham Verghese, treated people with AIDS in a small town that was slow to admit it was part of the AIDS epidemic. From 1985 to 1990, he was a staff physician at a hospital in Johnson City, Tennessee. Dr. Verghese didn't initially set out to treat people with AIDS, but his specialty was infectious diseases, and his medical studies coincided with the rise of the epidemic. He's written a memoir about his AIDS work in Tennessee called My Own Country. America is actually Dr. Verghese's adopted country. He grew up in Ethiopia, where his parents had moved from India. Dr. Verghese first came to America in 1973 to study medicine. He continued his studies in India, then returned to America in 1980. He says that in the absence of a cure for AIDS, his job was to minister to the patient's soul and psyche, to pay attention to his family and his social situation, to make more house visits. But all of this came at a price.
Well, I think conventional medicine doesn't really gear itself to providing that kind of care. And one of the first things that you realize when you enter the field of taking care of people with HIV infection is that when you have nothing to offer in terms of a cure, you still have a lot to give. And perhaps what you have to give is very akin to what physicians at the turn of the century gave. That is to say, your presence, your concern, your willingness to be there with them through some of their suffering. And when I began to realize that this was the commodity I had to offer, it was disappointing to see that there really wasn't room in the grand scheme of medical care for me to do that and still, you know, use my time efficiently and even get reimbursed for that kind of time. But I think AIDS brings about a great distinction between healing and curing. One of the interesting things to me is that all of us who work in HIV care have come to recognize this distinction, and physicians are fortunate enough to be in specialties where you can just administer a cure almost seem to have had that part of themselves atrophy. They're not really all that comfortable or aware of the impact that they have on their patients or can have in this fashion.
Let me ask you to elaborate on the distinction you're making between healing and curing.
Well, I think that, you know, at the turn of the century, when a physician who I admire, like Osler, who's a very important academic physician, and many of the things we do in academic circles reflects Osler's teaching. But when he saw a case of pneumonia, he would go over the patient carefully, percuss the lung, auscultate the lung, and then provide his treatment, which in those days were various forms of inhalation and poultices and so on. And at the very same time, an American Indian physician, say, would also sort of diagnose the disease his own way and have his own treatment, which might consist of certain medicines and rituals and so on. When penicillin came along, the Western physician, I feel, pretty much just stepped back from the bedside and said, well, here's the penicillin. I don't really need to sit with you and minister to you. Whereas the American Indian shaman recognized the importance of penicillin, but also recognized the importance of continuing to provide the sort of healing function. And I sense that some of the resentment that the public has for physicians as a whole comes because we stepped away from that sort of healing function with our obsession with cure. And the more technologically sophisticated we've become, the less comfortable we seem to be with the idea of, you know, our presence and our care and our concern being of itself, a healing. And all of us who have entered AIDS care have come to realize that since this is all we have to offer, it's something that we need to pay attention to, and we've come to realize that it's not trivial at all. In fact, it's a wonderful thing to be able to bring about that kind of a healing, even when the disease that you're dealing with ultimately winds up taking their life.
How did you decide how much of your time, and therefore of your family's time, was the appropriate amount of time to give, and where it was perhaps appropriate to draw the line and say, I have to save this time for myself or my wife or my children?
I found that extremely difficult to do. I found myself really being pulled across this threshold where there's a sort of threshold that we all seem to stop at instinctively as physicians. But there's something about HIV care, at least in my setting, which was that I was looking at young men who were the same sex as I was, the same age as I was for the most part, had the same aspirations, and I could identify with them. And it was almost like looking at a reflection of myself. And I found that I could really not begrudge them my time when it seemed to be all I had to offer. And as time went on, AIDS became like this secret mistress that kept drawing me away from my family, that kept being something that pulled me away from other responsibilities, and at the same time, not something I could talk about freely, because I couldn't really expect anyone else to empathize with that experience. And the question they would immediately ask me is, well, you know, why do you, if it's, so disturbing to you, why do you give so much of your time from it? Why don't you just pull back?
And that would have been hard to do.
That would have been, at the time, I couldn't conceive of it.
How did your wife feel when you were in Johnson City about all the time that you were spending with people with AIDS? Was she more worried than you were about contracting the virus and perhaps spreading it to the family?
I think that initially we had concerns primarily because there were several times when I had needle sticks, and I think all of us who work in this field from time to time do that. And we went the condom and the abstinence route. And, you know, to even bring this up with your spouse, even though you know that it's a very low-risk thing to be stuck by a needle, there are not that many instances of the virus being transmitted in that fashion. Nonetheless, to bring this up is to bring something home from work and lay it on the dining table, so to speak, and it lingers there as a presence long after the danger, so to speak, is over. I think that she worried about what was happening to me, that I clearly was becoming a different kind of physician than my peers in this small town, that as time went on, I began to feel, and I think this was true, that I had become tainted by the association. And the association of AIDS in a small town is not just plague. It's more than that. It also speaks to a certain kind of sexuality. It's not even a sexually transmitted disease. It's a disease that points at homosexuality in a very peculiar way that perhaps is less so in New York City or Philadelphia or places like that. But in that town, the association was such that even blood transfusion recipients and hemophiliacs, when you pin them down as to what it was that they were hiding from, it was the association not with plague but with homosexuality, when in their case it didn't really apply. And in some ways I was becoming tainted by this, and being the AIDS doctor in a town is a dubious distinction in a small town in Tennessee. And I think she worried about this, and she was concerned that it was affecting the way we were perceived in this town and affecting the way some of her interactions went. I can remember her telling me that the wife of a physician I would call on from time to time to do a bronchoscopy, the wife told my wife that every time I called with a consult, he experienced a great deal of trepidation because he didn't know if I was calling for him to do a procedure on one of my AIDS patients. So as you can see, there were many ramifications outside of the medical sphere into our personal and social lives.
I guess confidentiality became very important to your patients. In Tennessee, were there extremes that you were expected to go to maintain the confidence about their illness?
It was the single most important issue about AIDS in a small town was secrecy. And I had people, actually who I describe in the book, who came to me from almost 100 miles away, had me go through the subterfuge of having them register under a different name and have me have me talk to their sons and basically tell the sons that he had a form of lymphoma, all because they couldn't imagine anyone in their town learning that they had AIDS. Now, they acquired AIDS by blood transfusion, in their own words, quotes, innocently, so to speak. But as the man told me, he said, if I was to ever step into my church having let the word out that I had AIDS, when I went for service, I would be the only one there. I think he was wrong, but the interesting thing is that that was the belief that prevailed.
most of the AIDS patients who you've dealt with have been gay. And before you started treating people with AIDS, you knew very few out-of-the-closet homosexuals. Did you have to overcome stereotypes of your own when you were first treating people with HIV?
Absolutely, and I think that the more I talk to my fellow physicians who are in the same position as I am, I think we all, males that is, we all made this peculiar voyage sort of across the gulf of our own homophobia to the point where I now feel like I missed something of value in my early years by denying myself the friendship of people who might have been gay or who were gay because I had the stereotyped image of them. And I think that it's a shame that it took a disease like AIDS to make a male like me make this voyage and come to this understanding. But I've actually come to the understanding that gay men have so much to teach heterosexual men about what it is to be a man. And again, it's tragic that a disease like this should bring that into relief.
You grew up in Ethiopia. Your parents are from India. Did you feel that being a foreigner and therefore an outsider in the United States helped you understand the outsider status that so many homosexuals have in American culture?
I think it did. I think I was very conscious of the fact that I was always looking for a place to call home. And the title, My Own Country, from my book, emanates from the sense of, this nebulous sense of finding a place to live. And I thought this was a curious parallel, that there I was, an alien, my green card was otherwise called the resident alien card, struggling to sort of fit in and, blend in and learn all the rituals of Monday night football and so on. And meanwhile, these gay men, this was their hometown, but this was a hometown that they felt alien in. And instead of trying to blend in, they had actually learned to sort of hide their true nature and fake this sort of blending in until that moment when they could make their escape. And so when they did come back, I often felt that part of the reason that they really opened up to me was the feeling that I would not pass judgment on them the same way their town fathers might, and perhaps even the feeling that I had no right as a foreign physician to pass judgment on them. I'm particularly remembering a preacher who would come to me repeatedly with sexually transmitted diseases and fairly glibly recount his experiences, and I always thought that he would only do this with me because he had a sense that not only would I not pass judgment, perhaps I had no right to pass judgment on his sexual behavior.
My guest is Dr. Abraham Verghese. His memoir, My Own Country, is about treating people with AIDS in Johnson City, Tennessee. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Abraham Verghese. I'd like you to describe for us the day you were awakened by a phone call from a dentist that you knew who had extracted a tooth from one of your patients.
It was a bizarre incident. I had been woken up early in the morning by this phone call from a dentist, and I'm not sure how he got my number. And he was absolutely distraught. He had discovered that the tooth he pulled the previous day, and it was a bloody extraction. He had to chip and wedge this tooth out, and there was blood everywhere, as he said. He discovered that this tooth he'd pulled out had come from a patient of mine who had HIV infection. And he was in tears. He was looking for me to sort of reassure him, and he was determined. He said he was going to give up his dental practice. And I took some time to reassure him, but I kept wondering, well, how did he find out that my patient had HIV, because I certainly didn't remember any such conversation, and I didn't set up the dental appointment because it was notoriously difficult to get dental care for my patients. It turned out that my patient had gone to a local pharmacy to get his penicillin filled in after this procedure, and the pharmacist, who also did a lot of my AZT prescriptions, had took it on himself to call up the dentist and say, by the way, do you know that you just pulled a tooth on so-and-so who happens to have HIV. And I was sort of trying to deal with his fear at the same time I was sort of outraged. And I made him force, I sort of forced him to tell me who had let the cat out of the bag, so to speak. And then I confronted the patient and said, you know, you really had an obligation to let the dentist know ahead of time so he could take appropriate precautions. And the patient came right back at me with what I thought was a fairly reasoned argument. He said, Doc, I tried everyone. My own dentist bumped me from my list. And I said, why did he do that? He said, well, I don't know. You tell me. Maybe he figured out that the only way to protect himself from HIV was to get all the Nellies out of his practice, is the words he used. And so he said, I just was frustrated. This tooth was bothering me. I couldn't get anyone to take it out when I told them I was HIV positive. So I just went through the phone book and picked someone, and I said to myself, this is 1987. This dentist should be protecting himself. It's not my responsibility. So my loyalties were very divided. I was very angry with the pharmacist for, you know, being unprofessional. I was angry with the patient for, you know, subjecting the dentist to this. And I was angry with the dentist for being somewhat cavalier, even though a week or two before I had addressed the Dental Society and told them that universal precautions weren't simply a matter of, you know, banding out these little aphorisms about wear this and do that. This was something real that they had to watch out for.
So you think that the dentist really should have been using rubber gloves and other precautions?
Evidently he was using gloves. His concern came from from the fact that he wasn't wearing a mask and his eyes weren't protected, and there was blood on his forearms, on his cheek, and he thought that he had splattered himself quite a bit. And I must tell you that in this day and age, that's not an uncommon event, and we know that those sorts of things aren't particularly infectious. You know, thousands and thousands of those kinds of exposures, splashes and so on, haven't really resulted in anyone, in too many people converting. So on the scale of things, I wasn't that worried, but he needed to treat every patient as though they were potentially HIV infected. But in that small town, it was something that he just didn't believe he had to do, and he thought he could probably sniff them out, spot them a mile away.
So what happened? He had said maybe he'd give up dentistry. He was so upset. What happened with him?
I'm not sure that I'm privy to what finally happened, because I think that part of what I did with him was to sort of lecture him. And I know that he subsequently got his HIV tests and that they were negative. Whether it altered his practice or not, I'm not certain.
Why did you leave practicing medicine in Johnson City?
Well, I have this sort of self-fulfilling hypothesis, I suppose, that all of us in AIDS care have this need from time to time to sort of find a new geography, almost as though a new set of faces will temporarily sort of clean the slate and allow us to sort of begin again. You know, a strange thing happens when you accrue 80-odd patients, and particularly when you're providing all their care. They somehow become connected to you, almost like children, and with each loss, there's a sense of having lost a part of yourself, and then the sense of all these others who are also, you know, going to get sicker. There's a part of me that felt I just wanted to start again somewhere else. I know very clearly that I wouldn't be in any other line of work, but I think from time to time you need a change of scenery, and I've done that twice now, and I know several other people who've made similar sort of transitions, never away from AIDS, but just a different locale, a new setting, a certain kind of anonymity that they'd lost completely in this little town.
So what are you doing now?
I'm now at Texas Tech University at El Paso. I'm chief of infectious diseases there. I teach at the medical school, have a huge stable of HIV clinic persons. The difference perhaps now is that I have more resources. I have associates with me. And perhaps more than ever, I think there's a sense that the most important ingredient in HIV care is strong community support, support groups, hospices, social services. And we have all that in place in a magnificent way in El Paso. And when I look back in Tennessee, I was trying to do all those different tasks by myself, and it was next to impossible.
In your memoir, My Own Country, about being an AIDS doctor in Johnson City, Tennessee, you write, "No matter how long I practice medicine, no matter what happens with this retrovirus, I will not be able to forget these young men, the little towns they came from, and the cruel, cruel irony of what awaited them in the big city. Let me ask you to elaborate.
Well, I compliment you for finding that paragraph, because that was really the heart of the book. And when I came to that, I cried. And because that was really the root of the book. That was the thing that drove me. And what this emanated from was this one scene that I'd like to describe to you, where I went to the house of a patient who had been ill for many months with raging fever, and I could not find the cause. And I'll call him Hobart, as he's named in the book. He said to me, after I die, if you want, you can come and take biopsies of my organs. I don't want an autopsy, but at least you'll know what went on. And so I went to his house. I traveled out there and walked through the living room where his parents were grieving alone, no relatives there to comfort them, because that was the nature of it. And I made my way into his bedroom and saw him lying there, you know, wasted and shriveled, almost Christ-like, lying there on a white sheet, his arms folded across his chest. And I was impressed by what was on the wall of this bedroom, which was his childhood bedroom. And it was all these icons from his childhood. It was needlepoint verses that his mother had put up and various other things. And I knew that this was a foreign environment to him, because I had seen photographs of his New York City apartment. I'd seen the icons that he had used to surround himself with. I knew what his memorabilia were. And it just seemed to me horribly tragic that he'd escaped this loving but confining world and gone to the big city. And at the very moment that Hobart discovered who Hobart was meant to be, that this virus should have entered his system, undermined his immune system, and cruelly brought him back to this loving home, but a home that was really not his own country. It was not where he wanted to be.
Did you see that a lot?
A lot. I mean, I think that was the prevailing paradigm. And I must say that families were loving, and even though they took the news of not only that their son had AIDS, but that he was gay and survived it and continued to sort of take care of them, they did so with certain restrictions. It was often difficult for other males to call and inquire and see how the son was doing. You know, it was love, but with certain restrictions and certain definitions. But I think I must say that, you know, people in Tennessee have an unfair reputation, perhaps, for being rednecks and being prejudiced. And I encountered very little of that. And I think that the flip side of being a redneck is sort of unconditional love, where you quickly get past the fact that, you know, your son has lived a way you don't approve, but this is your son, this is your kin, and you take care of your kin. That story, that you know, courage that families express despite being exposed to something so absolutely foreign to them in terms of gay men and AIDS, the courage they expressed is really admirable too.
Were you expected to be something of a cultural intermediary in situations like that between your patient who was dying and his parents?
I often wound up being one. I found myself more than once explaining homosexuality, because I would be asked this question, well, doc, how do they get that way? And, you know, it was a question that obviously I had wrestled with too, and I'd come to my own sort of understanding of it, and I would sort of, you know, I would say, look, you know, the God-given talent that you're so proud about with your son, I think his gayness is also, you know, a God-given gayness, if you will. I really do subscribe to the business of this being nature and not nurture. And yes, I functioned as sort of a intermediary, someone whom they knew was heterosexual and yet was sympathetic. And so perhaps they looked to me to sort of help explain this world that they were discovering in their sick son.
Dr. Abraham Verghese has written a new memoir called My Own Country. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More with Dr. Verghese in the second part of our show.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation with Dr. Abraham Verghese. In the late 1980s, Dr. Verghese treated people with AIDS in Johnson City, Tennessee, a town that didn't think of itself as part of the AIDS epidemic. Most of his patients were gay men who had fled to large cities to escape homophobia and were now returning home to die. Dr. Verghese understood the rejection his patients experienced. Born in Ethiopia of Indian parents, he was an outsider in America. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Last of the Independents, the Pretenders' first album in 4 years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis was laid to rest today in Arlington National Cemetery, reunited with her first husband, the late John F. Kennedy. Friends and family remembered her as a woman with a love of family and a spirit of adventure. President Clinton spoke of her strength during times of trouble.
God gave her very great gifts and imposed upon her great burdens. She bore them all with dignity and grace and uncommon common sense. In the end, she cared most about being a good mother to her children, and the lives of Caroline and John leave no doubt that she was that and more.
The funeral was held this morning in New York, where hundreds of people gathered outside. During that service, Senator Edward Kennedy eulogized his sister-in-law as a blessing to us and to the nation, and a lesson to the world on how to do things right. The latest truce in Bosnia-Herzegovina failed even before it went into effect. The Serb leaders had signed a peace agreement Saturday pledging to withdraw its forces from a buffer zone around the Muslim enclave of Garajda. They were supposed to be out by yesterday. Not only haven't they left, but they're building new bunkers and restricting UN movements in the area. The Muslim-led government is now boycotting any more peace talks until this matter is resolved. Faced with mounting complaints about secondhand smoke and dwindling places where smokers can smoke, the tobacco industry is fighting back. The R.J. Reynolds Company has launched an ad campaign to say that secondhand smoke isn't all that bad. UPI's Pi Chamberlain reports.
A doctor who works for Reynolds Tobacco, Chris Coggins, said that animal studies show very few effects of breathing secondhand smoke. Asked about studies that show that non-smoking people who live with smokers seem to suffer from it, he said that may not have to do with smoke at all.
Wives of smokers and smokers tend to become, like all couples, concordant. They become more like each other. Smokers have a much more risky lifestyle than do non-smokers. They tend to drink more alcohol, more coffee, more fatty food, take less exercise, less vegetables, less vitamins.
Reynolds says it will run print ads and hold news conferences throughout the summer. Pi Chamberlain, Washington.
Police in Indianapolis say some of the hostages held at a Denny's restaurant have been freed. About 15 people are still inside, captives of two gunmen who apparently tried to rob the place just before lunchtime. At least 4 people were injured, including a 5-year-old boy. There is one report as yet unconfirmed that one person died in the original shooting. Stocks closed lower on Wall Street today as a sharp rise in commodity prices fueled fears of more inflation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 24 points to close at 3742.41. Declines led advances by a margin of 4-3 in heavy trading. This is National Public Radio News. A trial is underway in Miami for a Haitian charged with hijacking a plane to Miami. NPR's Derek Reveron reports from Miami.
The trial of Woody Mark Edouard focuses attention on the U.S. government's disparate treatment of Haitian and Cuban refugees. In February 1993, Edouard pulled a gun on the pilot of a Haitian missionary plane and forced him to fly to Miami. But today, Edouard's lawyers asked the judge to drop charges against Edouard because Cubans who divert planes to the U.S. are not prosecuted. Edouard's lawyers pointed out that 2 months before Edouard's alleged hijacking, a Cuban pilot diverted an airliner to Miami and wasn't prosecuted. Edouard's lawyers also reminded the judge that just a few weeks ago, another Cuban pilot diverted a plane to Miami, and he hasn't been prosecuted either. However, the judge declined to drop the charges against Edouard. The trial is expected to take 1 to 2 weeks. I'm Derek Reveron reporting.
The Supreme Court today ruled that federal courts have no authority to interfere with the procedure for closing military installations. Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter had sued, challenging the shutdown of a shipyard in his home state. The court ruled unanimously that the president has discretion to make such decisions without being second-guessed by the courts. In another matter, the justices let stand a lower court ruling allowing a man to be bumped from a jury because of his religion. The prosecutor in the Minnesota case had exercised a peremptory challenge, saying her experience was that Jehovah's Witnesses are reluctant to convict. And a Georgia couple who won a $101 million judgment against General Motors lost in the Supreme Court. Without comment, the high court rejected an appeal by Thomas and Elaine Mosley. They'll now have to give back most of the money to the state. Under a Georgia law, anyone who wins punitive damages must surrender 75% of it. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Abraham Verghese. He's written a memoir about how the AIDS epidemic looked from the vantage point of a doctor in a small town during the second part of the 1980s. His memoir about his work in Johnson City, Tennessee, is called My Own Country. The memoir is also about his experiences as a foreign doctor in America. Dr. Verghese grew up in Ethiopia. His parents were from the south of India. Dr. Verghese told me what brought them to Ethiopia.
My community is a Christian community in the south of India, and our Christianity supposedly originates from St. Thomas the Apostle having landed on the coast of India and converted some Brahmins there. So even my name, Verghese, really is akin to the Verghese of the Italians and the Verghese of Greeks and so on. In fact, I'm often addressed as Verghese, and it seems to come very naturally to my Italian friends. But the emperor, Haile Selassie, when he got Mussolini out of his country, came on a state visit to India to see the churches of St. Thomas in the south of India. And I think he was very taken with the sight that at 7:45 in the morning there were these hordes of schoolchildren heading to school, because that state, Kerala, is still one of the most literate states in India. And he was so moved by that that he decided that he was going to hire all his teachers for the schools he was setting up across his country from this one state. So in a very peculiar fashion, my father and mother and 400 to 500 other teachers were hired, and my father and mother met there, and my brother and I were born in Ethiopia and grew up there.
So after growing up in Ethiopia, why did you decide to study medicine in the United States?
Well, actually, I began to study medicine in Ethiopia when the war broke out and the emperor was deposed. And I think until then I had a sense that that was my place in the world, even though
Ethiopia,
we were still Indian citizens, but I was fluent in the language, my friends were all Ethiopian. And that was sort of a moment of definition for me, because it suddenly became apparent that when they used the phrase expatriates and outsiders, they were referring to me, unbelievably. And so I had no more place in that country. We were literally asked to leave. And I came to America, where my parents had already come. And for a year or so, I worked as an orderly in nursing homes and hospitals, trying to get back on track. But my status as sort of a displaced person made it very difficult to sort of make the transition from their schools in Ethiopia to America. So I went back to India, because the Indian government accepted my situation and took me in. And then when I finished there, I came to America to join my parents again and seek further training here. In a sense, the book, you know, the title, My Own Country, is all about that sense of searching for a place where I can be, a country I can identify with, a place that I can set roots in. And in a way, the search still goes on. I'm an American and very proud to be one. The search for an identity, a place that you can spin your little personal myth, I think continues. Although I must say that in arriving in El Paso, I felt I'd finally arrived in a place where I could perhaps disappear. I mean, El Paso, as you know, has a huge Hispanic population, and my coffee-colored skin sort of blends in there, and I have the sense of having finally disappeared in America, if you will.
When you were trying to get established in American medicine, did you find that there were certain hospitals that were more open to accepting interns or residents from foreign countries?
Well, yes, indeed. In fact, it's very clear that there's a two-tiered system of medicine at the graduate level when you come to this country. Foreign physicians are absolutely critical to the running of inner-city hospitals like, say, Cook County, to name a few. who wouldn't survive without this influx of manpower year after year.
Why wouldn't they survive?
Well, I think because it's difficult to attract young American graduates, particularly in fields like internal medicine that are not necessarily lucrative. It's difficult to attract internal medicine interns and residents to places like, inner city urban hospitals when they could go to more prestigious academic centers or more fancy hospitals in smaller towns. And so year after year, we recruit. I mean, even in my place, we are doing this, recruit physicians from foreign countries to fill our acute manpower needs because many city hospitals rely on these patients, on these physicians to provide patient care.
What were you culturally unprepared for when you started working in American inner city hospitals after growing up in Ethiopia?
Well, I think, what would be interpreted by some as being, horrendous working conditions, when you compare them to the conditions in places I had worked in Africa and Ethiopia and India were really fine. I mean, I had really very little cause for complaint. I actually bypassed the inner city hospital and wound up going to Tennessee to do my residency and then came back to Boston City Hospital to do my fellowship and then went back again. So I saw the whole spectrum, of medical care in this country. And I think the thing we have to remember is that it's so vastly superior to what is available elsewhere that some of these differences are relative. Nonetheless, foreign graduates coming in really have very little choice. They're shunted to these programs. And then later on, it's difficult for them to break through, even at the fellowship or specialty training level, into the more desirable specialties because, again, they've come from a residency or a training program that is considered to be in this second level.
My guest is Dr. Abraham Verghese. His memoir, My Own Country, is about being a foreign doctor in America and treating people with AIDS in Johnson City, Tennessee. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Abraham Verghese. His new memoir, My Own Country, is about being an AIDS doctor. I think some American patients are probably uncomfortable with foreign doctors because the patients fear that they won't be understood. Either their language won't be understood if the doctor doesn't speak English as a first language, or they fear they won't be understood on some kind of like larger metaphorical level when they're describing their symptoms or trying to describe in shorthand who they are and what their larger problems are. Did you run across this a lot?
Yes, I did. I think it's really a remarkable sort of situation. I think it's a testament to this country and our openness that we can have situations like that. But I always thought it was a strange paradox to be in a small mining town in Tennessee where people were really intensely sort of inbred and, full of regional myths and heavy accents. And for them to be taken care of from someone from a totally different culture with his or her own mythology, her own accent and so on, it was really curious to see these two worlds come together. The interesting thing is that with time, once one gets over that initial sort of discomfort, foreign physicians, by and large, have an excellent reputation for being sound physicians, for being caring. Perhaps they don't have a very good reputation for blending in with the community. I think many have retained those elements that made them different. And many in the community have seen that as being somewhat standoffish or somewhat opportunistic even. But I continue to be struck, even today, when I go to a VA hospital to visit or to give grand rounds to see veterans in some of the oldest veteran hospitals in the country being taken care of by the newest immigrants. It's at once a tribute to this country and at the same time sort of very curious.
Did you find that your American patients had a different standard of comfort or health than the patients who you'd seen in Ethiopia? What they considered to be normal and acceptable?
Absolutely. I think that, so much of medicine and Ethiopia and countries like India isn't driven by physicians. It isn't driven by what a physician has to offer. It's driven by what money there is available. And, you know, I worked in a clinic in India briefly where all I had to offer my patient was scabies ointment and vitamin A pills and some oral penicillin, although it was limited. So it didn't matter what they came in with. I had to, in terms of therapy, this is all I had to offer. And I think many people see foreign physicians as coming to this country chasing a financial dream, and perhaps that's true, but I think they're also chasing the opportunity to sort of fulfill themselves as physicians. Because if you're going to work for the government, the ingredient that the government lacks that you will need to provide good medical care is money. And so you either wind up working for the private sector in fancy hospitals that cater to, often to people from the Middle East who don't quite have enough money to get to London or Sloan Kettering, and they come to Bombay and Madras for their transplants or whatever. You find yourself in that curious situation of providing medical care to those who have a lot of money. And I think this is at the root of much of the frustration that results in foreign physicians looking to come to America.
You've been treating people with AIDS for how long now?
Well, I've been involved with AIDS since 83, almost the year before the HIV test became available. All my professional life as an infectious disease specialist. And I must tell you that I entered infectious disease because I thought this is the one specialty where we can cure people. You have to understand, there was a very exciting era, antibiotics, and we were making such gains with leukemics and transplant patients. And the moment I started training, AIDS arrived. And when I say this to medical students, that I entered I entered infectious disease because of the possibility of cure, they really break out laughing. They think it's hilarious.
Do you get yourself tested? No.
I don't routinely. I only do when I get splashed or exposed. And when I do, a curious thing happens. My life seems to come to a standstill until I get the result. And therefore, I don't really get tested unless I'm convinced that, you know, that it's intellectually a smart thing to do because of a certain event. I really don't feel at risk in almost anything I do with my patients. I'm quite comfortable with that. I must tell you, the thing I worry about more than anything else, and I think this is true of all my colleagues, is multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. If people drop out from AIDS care, it will not be AIDS. It will be the threat of something like that that is truly untreatable and it's truly a menace.
How often are you splashed in such a way that you feel is necessary to get tested?
Well, I do bronchoscopies. Perhaps I'm exceptional in that I'm an infectious disease physician who does a pulmonary procedure. I'm actually board certified in pulmonary medicine. And I think over the years, many of us have wound up doing lots of things that pertain to other specialties just because we didn't want to subject someone else to the sort of hassle of saying, would you mind doing this? And they say, sure, but inside they're saying, gosh, I wish you wouldn't ask me. So we do bone marrow biopsies, we do bronchoscopies, we do skin biopsies. And in the course of all that, I'd say once a year or so, it's not uncommon to have some sort of exposure and then have the need to go get tested.
How did you start writing?
I had been writing all along little essays that sort of stemmed from you know, what I would see at work, and I'd been publishing them fairly successfully, and then began to write short stories. And I kept feeling that I was writing out of this urgent need to somehow transform what I was seeing at work because it was so disturbing. And initially it was in the form of journal entries. And then since I could not control death, since I could not turn back time, since I was always limited as a scientist by the boundaries of the real world, I absolutely enjoy delving into fiction where I can do all these things. I can turn back time, I can successfully reverse things, I can enter other people's heads. It's in a way, it's a necessary escape for me.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Abraham Verghese, his new memoir is called My Own Country. Dr. Verghese is now professor of medicine and chief of infectious diseases at Texas Tech Health Sciences Center in El Paso, Texas.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Robert Siegel and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. What do you have, Robert?
Well, Terry, we'll be hearing today about the funeral services for Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. First, the service in a New York church for 1,000 members of her family and also friends. And then the burial at Arlington National Cemetery, where, among others, President Clinton spoke. Also today, an interview with V.S. Naipaul, the writer born on Trinidad to a family from India, who has since written many novels. This one, the latest, Away in the World, is about the New World and what it means to be from the New World. We'll talk about that. Also today, the news from Haiti, as tighter sanctions were applied today.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Chrissy Hynde and her band The Pretenders made their first album in 1980 in the wake of punk and new wave music. The group's new release, Last of the Independents, is the first Pretenders album in 4 years. And rock critic Ken Tucker says it's their best work in a decade. All my dreams still relive you. This is what you left for me. I forgive you. Never do I despair when I kneel to say my prayers. When summer fills my head, I'll be visiting your bed.
I'm hard-pressed to think of another rock and roll singer whose voice is more expressive, more emotionally alert than Chrissy Hynde's. Listening to Last of the Independents, you can't help but be struck by the serene skill and authority of her deep, quavering vocals. When Hynde sings of an intense love affair on All My Dreams, she says, "No drug-induced bliss could ever reach the heights of this." And her slurred tone is at once groggy and erotic, the exact musical equivalent of the state of mind her words describe. Songs expand and contract to fit the mood she's in. Covering Bob Dylan's Forever Young, Hynde takes 5 languid minutes to meditate on middle age. But getting drunk in a bar on a tune called Tequila, she becomes so miserably sad and depressed, she can't keep this song going for much more than a minute.
I drink tequila and watch the game in the bar. I don't care who loses. I don't know who the teams are. We had our time, but the bells finally tolled. My Ohio winter was finally too cold.
Another striking song here is 977, in which Hynde half talks, half sings long lines crammed with words. It sounds like a woman daydreaming, imagining a conversation she wants to have with her lover. 977 is all about power and how it shifts back and forth between two people in a romance. When I saw my baby cry, she sings in the chorus, I knew that he loved me. Here Hynde is articulating rock song sentiments usually reserved for men with remorseless satisfaction.
When you try to cut me down and push me back, if I attack your attitude, I rise up to the challenge, cause I like to taste the sugar of your violent mood. Just like a stormy sea, you're natural. Oh, it's easy to me. When I saw my baby cry, when I saw
over the last few years, a raft of female musicians have come along to work their own variations on blunt rock and roll. such as Polly Jane Harvey, The Breeders, and Liz Phair. They all owe Hind for the example she originally set as a post-punk woman who played the boys' game with warm irony. In this sense, her 1980 debut, Pretenders, haughty yet intimate, graced by a tough love humorousness, remains an inspirational thrill. With Last of the Independents, Hind sounds ready to reclaim her place as a vital musician, with new romantic scores to settle and new grudges to nurse.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the Pretenders' new album, Last of the Independents. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our interns are Devin Reif, Ann Neville, and Philo Holland. Our program was directed today by Naomi Person. I'm Terry Gross.
I was born with my hand in a fist and my eyes shut tight. Any wonder that I can't resist punching blindly in a fight? First time I saw swans flying to the sun, I wanted to be one. Like every mother's son, when I saw my life had begun, I wanted to be someone. Like my brother, my one and only father. And like every mother's son.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the civil rights movement through the eyes of one of its foremost lawyers. We talk with Jack Greenberg about his 35 years with the NAACP. He represented Martin Luther King and won for him the right to march from Birmingham to Selma. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.